It's the most expensive election season of all time, so where's the money coming from?
Follow the money.
It's coming from everywhere. It's coming from small donations, from billionaires, coming from women in record-breaking numbers. So we're just smashing records right and left.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and we're talking election season cash today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, November 17th. Plus, baseball has its first female general manager.
How much autonomy is she going to have? How much respect will she be given as her due by the people that she's interacting with? These are all questions I think that have yet to be answered.
Then we talked to writer and director Steve McQueen and actor Letitia Wright about their latest series, Small Acts. And the pandemic has caused financial hardships for many, but the older population has been hit especially hard. The COVID-19 pandemic has devastated the U.S. economy and led to record unemployment for people of all ages. But older workers have been hit particularly hard, with some losing their jobs and others being forced into early retirement. People over 55 are facing higher unemployment rates than their younger counterparts for the first time since the mid-1970s. The financial situation is even worse for older women or older people of color who are less likely to have retirement savings to begin with.
Hi, this is Joe. I'm a 56-year-old African-American male living in Dallas, Texas. At the start of this year, I was working doing construction while I completed the requirements to get my real estate license and start selling homes. In March, when Corona hit, my construction jobs and my licensing was put on hold for 5 months. To add insult to injury, 2 months after signing up with a new broker, I caught the virus. I've been at home, quarantined, and struggling to breathe clearly. At my age, I'm not sure what the overall impact on my life will be.
And once older Americans are unemployed, they have a much more difficult time bouncing back. According to the AARP, it can take older people twice as long to find work as younger workers.
Hi, I'm Robin Scott. I'm calling from El Cerrito, California. I am 59 years old, and I have been laid off from my job as a sound engineer at a local Berkeley music venue, where there's not really much of a chance I'm going to be going back to that job anytime soon. So I have started doing some work on the side. I used to be a computer technician, and I've started assisting seniors with their computers because I can do it remotely.
And experts say there are going to be very serious economic consequences to this down the line, with the pandemic forcing some older Americans out of the middle class and into poverty or near poverty once in retirement. I'm Tanzina Vega, and that's where we start today on The Takeaway. I'm joined now by Teresa Ghilarducci, the director of the New Schools Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis. Teresa, welcome to the show.
Oh, hello, Tanzina. Glad to be here.
So we just heard some calls from our listeners who are older listeners. And I got to be honest, Teresa, that's pretty heartbreaking to hear people who are in their 50s who are struggling to find work. How broad is this issue right now?
Well, for the first time in 50 years, we saw that older workers had higher unemployment rates with this pandemic repression, and now what we are in is kind of an ordinary recession. So it's big. It's over, 4 million older workers are now out of work, and these are people who are actively seeking work. They tell surveyors that they've lost their job and they're looking for work. We have millions more who have dropped out of the labor force. I'm quite worried about them because when we look in the past, like over the last 10 years, over the 50 years, in the last recession, we did not have so many older workers as a proportion of their workforce leave the labor force and be unemployed. So I'm just concerned about the impact for their financial futures.
Teresa, we've talked on this show about how even being over 40 can make it difficult for somebody to find a job because our society is so focused on younger workers and young people. What is unique about this moment for older workers because of the pandemic? I mean, many of these folks have probably struggled to find work prior to the pandemic. How has the pandemic exacerbated this issue?
Well, it is really important for us to remember that this pandemic is really affecting people with less than sort of college or advanced degrees or at the very top of the earnings distribution. So what's also different about this pandemic is not just age, it's hitting older people worse than in the past, but also people who are earning like less than $70,000 per year. So we have a class, race, gender, and age issue going on. We have to look at by groups. But in terms of age, the one thing the virus does is not discriminate by those income classes, but it does discriminate by age. Because of immunosenescence, meaning that as you get older, you're much more likely to be sick if you get this disease. You're not more likely to get it, just like people of color because of their race aren't more likely to get it. But people with older people who are non-white and have less education are more likely to be around people with COVID. So that's why they're likely to get it. But if you're older, because your immunity system declines with age, just your cells are less bouncy, you're more likely to get sicker. So there's a supply and demand issue going on here. Older people are more likely to get sick. They may be more reluctant to work, but I think that employers are more reluctant to hire them and want them out if they have a layoff. There's also an issue of the Trump administration not enforcing age discrimination laws as well as the Department of Labor could. So employers may feel this is a once-in-a-lifetime chance to get rid of older workers who may be also more expensive if they're in the employer's health care plan.
We should note also that age discrimination claims generally, not just under the Trump administration, but under previous administrations, are very difficult to prove. It's one of the most difficult areas to prove intent to. And we've talked about that on this show, which really hurts workers, even those who are just over 40. Let's talk a little bit about folks who are trying to find work. There are people who have lost their jobs and are scrambling to find new jobs. What are the unique challenges for older people who are searching for a job right now?
One may be just you have to do it on Zoom. So it's important that older people, that all people, are very comfortable with Zoom, with electronic video conferencing. Probably their phone is their best friend rather than their computer. It's also really important for all job applicants to be able to know how to submit a resume that will be read by a computer. And so it's very important for older people to understand not to put anything on their resume that might reflect their age. It's illegal for employers with computer screening to search for age, but you have to know how to not put the age that you graduated from high school or college on your resume. The most important advice I can give to older workers is that if you have a chance to talk to an employer, even if the job posted isn't perfect for you, talk to that employer because employers often don't know what they want. And when they meet somebody who knows the company, understands the company's needs, and that worker, that applicant, is ready to solve the employer's needs and not just always talks about themselves, but talks about how their unique skills, ability, and vision can meet the employer's needs, then you may talk yourself into a new job. They may actually redesign the job for you. So employers hire people. They don't just hire people to fill a job.
So there was a piece in a website, Refinery29, that sort of talks to younger folks saying that maybe this idea of the perfect job and the all-fulfilling job is obsolete. And I've always, as someone who's a Gen Xer, I've always thought that that fulfilling job never really was a reality. I mean, are older workers in a better position to do exactly what you've said, to stop looking for work that sort of is personally fulfilling and just really look to do the job as it is outlined by the employer?
I think that older workers might be more flexible than younger people just because of their experience. It really is important to reflect on your own experience and how flexible you might be. Also, a job interview is about persuasion, and it's really important to understand that you're solving the employer's problem. So talking about that rather than yourself or the kinds of talents or your own aspirations, it's much better to talk about the employer rather than your own aspirations.
Are there specific industries that older workers should be looking at that are potentially a better fit for them, given what we're talking about right now with all the limitations of not being able to meet in person or having to apply via Zoom?
I think that there are industries that are growing and there are industries that are shrinking. So it's good for all applicants to go for the industries that are growing. It's anything to do with computers or computer connections like we're doing now, of course, is growing, but that isn't a friendly place. Tech is not a friendly place for older workers. Any industry that your skills and education level can meet is important. So you have to be broad. The care industry, I think education is a place that is scrambling to find out how to reconfigure it so that children are in smaller pods. It really depends upon the older person's education level, but it's one thing for sure, Tanzina, and you're almost near it, is that an older person will have to be ready to leave the industry they were in and look at different industries.
That's how realistic is that given where we are right now, though? Because there's a lot of talk about people who are pivoting or people who could do, you know, change industries. But right now we're in the middle of a pandemic that doesn't appear to be letting up, at least for another couple of months, at least for this season, if not longer. How are older folks supposed to be expected to pivot that quickly?
Well, no, I think that if you're unemployed now, you might take advantage of the time, especially at home, really learning new skills on the computer. I do agree with you. Switching jobs, looking for new venues is terrible in a recession. That always works when the economy is expanding. It works a lot better when employers are hungry to hire. So if you're unemployed and you set aside some time for personal job development every day, you know, a little bit on job search, but a lot on job development. Make sure that when you're on Zoom, you can find the leave meeting button, that you know how to share a presentation, that you just can work around your phone. Those kinds of skill development, you know, 1 hour, 2 hours a day is important. So it's just not realistic. We do have some public policies that I have geared up for the new administration that comes out of our research at the new school. I hope that the new administration and the Senate considers the plight of older workers and understands that they need to get unemployment relief to those older workers as soon as possible. Everybody needs some, but we are proposing that unemployment benefits be triggered for people over 40, over 50, and they can collect a few months longer to reflect the fact it takes longer to find a new job. Also, an idea that's really taking fire is Medicare is lowering the Medicare age to 50. And if that became the first payer, that employers could put their older workers on Medicare, that would reduce the cost of older workers by tens of thousands of dollars.
Something that really hits home, because a lot of older Americans are also probably taking care of multiple people. They're probably not just taking care of themselves, but they may be taking care of older relatives. They may be helping younger people, their kids and others. What does it mean for the American economy when older people are out of work?
When older people in America are out of work, it means a huge part of the experienced labor force is out of work, and that loses a lot of productive capacity for the American economy. Now, some of that is made up for the fact that older people out of work are taking care of other people, and often they have to leave the labor force to take care of other people. Most of that is because women who are older are tasked with that care work, either for their spouses or less so with their grandchildren. So that's why this pandemic is hitting older women workers even more than older males.
I know somebody who's struggling with this in particular, and I'm sort of concerned about their mental health. It can be depressing to be looking for work after a certain amount of time, and then you add to that this pandemic and everything else, that the news cycle, which has been brutal. Let's talk a little bit about the concerns that the unemployment rate and job losses among older people will have on their mental health.
So isolation, being in your 50s, and being lower income are all risk factors for depression and stress, but mostly depression. And when you're an out of work, older worker, in your 50s, you hit the jackpot for depression. So an older worker out of work must know that that's a problem and be quick about talking to a mental health provider or their doctor about their concerns about depression. It's almost inevitable, and there should be no hesitation with an older worker to address that part of their mental health right away. There is really no sense in the public service announcements or in the discussion about COVID relief about how to cope with isolation and being unemployed. There's just nothing from the CDC or from the coronavirus task force. And I would like to see a comprehensive task force deal with these social consequences, you know, of the unique aspects of a pandemic, which is isolation.
Older people also have a tendency to be more resilient, given a lot of what they have experienced. Just plain experience can sometimes make you more able or better able to manage even what for many of us is an unprecedented situation. So how are you seeing, is there a silver lining to this? Is resilience part of the equation? Is where do we see older workers, let's say a year from now? What are some pieces of advice other than being able to navigate you know, technology well that you would offer even just from an emotional standpoint right now?
What is really remarkable about older people is that as they get older, their mental well-being does seem to just trend up. And researchers think it is because of the wisdom that comes from experience, that special knowledge. It's a special kind of education. And so what I expect in a year is that older workers going through a financial difficulty will understand that they're resilient about changing their spending habits, that they will find new sources of income and actually find new sources of savings. I like the fact that older workers are going to be more experienced in fighting their medical bills and getting on the phone if there's a stray charge on their credit card. So we might find older workers spending a lot of time now investigating how to protect themselves against financial predators and kind of be feisty and fight back. So that's a big part of financial management, is figuring out how to reduce your costs and manage your money. I also expect that older workers and older people are going to come out of this pandemic amazed about how much tech they know. And about, even if they're on the computer more, steering away from social media and going to more news sites, they may be shocked to understand that they understand contact tracing and disease management. And they may even know a lot more about our electoral system since we got a deep dive into the way our government works. So this time alone and this time with the computer may be a time of reflection and learning. And out of that will come a lot more creativity and curiosity about how they can find a new job. I really hope that the federal government does what it needs to do in this kind of recession, and that is to give income relief. But we do know that a lot of programs that older workers are eligible for, or unemployed older workers are eligible for, don't have a lot of take-up. So that they really do need to explore the eligibility for home assistance, for rental assistance, for home mortgage relief, from food stamps. There's a lot of people who are eligible for food stamps for the SNAP program that don't get it. They may reach out to a community, an AARP organization or a community organization, to find out what programs they are available for. So with experience and age could come a lot of knowledge about how to work the system.
Teresa Ghilarducci is the director of the New School Schwartz Center for Economic Policy Analysis. Teresa, thanks so much.
It was wonderful talking to you, Tenzina. Thank you.
Hi, this is Arlene Jacobs from Tampa, Florida. I'm 56 years old, and I have definitely hit a wall when it comes to working from home. Things that I normally did before don't work during this COVID time, and I have a very hard time, making sales, making appointments when people don't want to meet face to face. I've moved to a virtual world, but it's much easier for people to disconnect or not attend virtual. And so it's definitely been a challenge. I have looked at trying something else, but I really don't know what else is out there for me, and I don't want to risk doing in-person work.
My name is Karen, and I'm calling from Maple Grove, Minnesota. I'm 60 years old, and my spouse is 58. The pandemic has greatly affected both of us. I own a small pet care business, and our net income has been reduced by approximately 75% due to clients staying home. I've laid off all my employees, which is 4 total, and I'm doing all of the work myself, trying to make ends meet. Financially, we can go a few more months. We have some savings, but it's very tough. We certainly ache for those who are worse off than we are.
The 2020 election season will be the most expensive in U.S. history. When the dust finally settles, the total amount spent on all of the elections this year, from the House to the Senate to the President, will be about $14 billion, according to the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan nonprofit that researches that kind of thing. Of that, $6.6 billion was spent on the presidential race alone, and that includes individual donations as well as big money donors and super PACs. And while the election is over, both presidential candidates are still asking for money. President-elect Biden and President Trump are emailing their supporters, asking them to dig a little deeper and give money to Biden's fight fund and Trump's official election defense fund. Sheila Krumholz is the executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, and she joins me now. Sheila, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So, I mean, I'm just sort of flabbergasted by the amount of money. $14 billion with a B, $6.6 billion spent on the presidential race alone. Where did this money come from, Sheila?
We were flabbergasted, too. We did not anticipate that. And where it's coming from is really interesting. It's coming from everywhere. It's coming from small donations, which have jumped from 15% of the money to 22% of the money. From billionaires like Sheldon and Marianne Adelson, who gave over $183 million, followed by Bloomberg, who gave over $100 million. It's coming from women in record-breaking numbers. 1.5 million women gave $2.5 billion, and that amounts to about 44% of individual donations, which is a record. So we're just smashing records right and left. And it's really, there's no one story about where the money is coming from. It's coming from everywhere.
So are we, how much can individuals donate to a campaign? Are there caps on what, say, I could donate to a campaign? Or is it pretty much anyone can donate however much they want?
Well, it's complicated. Yes, an individual is limited to $2,800 per election. So $2,800 for the primary, $2,800 for the general, and now in Georgia, $2,800 for the runoff. However, many, many national campaigns and increasingly state and other campaigns have super PACs that are single candidate super PACs, effectively set up to be a slush fund for a particular campaign. And so they can raise and spend money independent of the candidate. They cannot coordinate with a candidate, but they can raise unlimited sums from unlimited sources, including corporations or unions or trade associations or billionaires like Mr. Adelson. And they can spend that just to elect or defeat, to try to support or attack a single candidate. So those really become an extension of the campaign, an important extension in competitive races.
How much of this money translates into actual results in terms of winning? And before we get to the presidential campaign, I want to talk about some of the Senate races we saw, because in particular here in The Takeaway, we looked at a number of Black Senate candidates who were running for office and had gotten tremendous amounts of money, particularly and Democrats more broadly, particularly after the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Did that money translate into seats?
Well, that too is both a little bit complicated and interesting this cycle. Typically, 9 out of 10 winning House candidates are the candidate that spent the most. So there is a definite strong correlation to money. In the Senate, there's more volatility. It depends greatly on the kind of idiosyncrasies of the races, of the candidates, of the states that have that are fielding races. But generally, in the last many years, it would fall in the 80%, 80 to 90% range. So yes, there's a strong correlation. This time in the Senate in particular, there's a much weaker correlation, but still north of 70% of the candidates that spent the most won. That said, of course, one of the big stories of this election is, was money wasted? The Democrats, many candidates came out of nowhere or, surged and drew a lot of money from coast to coast. And so there was, we saw in the South Carolina Senate race, for instance, Graham Harrison, $180 million was raised by all of the candidates. In Arizona, Kelly McSally, $145 million. Kentucky, $144 million. So huge sums of money. You can't, though, just look again at the money spent by the candidates. We also have to consider the money spent by the outside groups. And when we do that, North Carolina Senate was actually the most expensive, with 67 from raised by the candidates, $220 million raised by outside groups. So all told, nearly $300 million spent just on that single race. It was just the Senate races were awash in money. And yeah, a lot of that money was probably raised late. Maybe too late to be spent efficiently, effectively, and maybe it's really not about the money. After some threshold amount, there are other factors that come into play or are even more important. So we always say money isn't everything. You can't rely on solely on money. That's why we don't have a self-funded Congress, by and large. But it is one critical factor. Without it, you can't win, but too much of it doesn't guarantee anything.
We mentioned at the top of the segment that both the Biden campaign and the Trump campaign are still reaching out to donors for more money. What do they need more money for at this point?
Yeah, they're still waging their legal battles. For Trump, it is to contest the results, and for Biden, it is to count every vote. And they're supported, too, by the party. The parties now have these legal accounts set up that they can use to dedicated to recounts and legal challenges, in about $22 million for the DNC and $14 million for the RNC. So they're still fundraising to support those efforts. Trump is also raising money for his new leadership PAC, which some say point to a 2024 potential run in 2024, and had been raising money to pay down his debt. So there are a number of things.
Now, I just want to stop you there for one second. To pay down his personal debt?
The campaign debt. So that had been something that was advertised in the joint fundraising committee that was raising funds. It was advertised in the fine print, but it was advertised as one of the things that donors would be helping to do.
Sheila, the $14 billion that's been spent on elections this year was calculated using Federal Election Commission records. Is there a chance that there's additional money that might not have been recorded, i.e. dark money?
Yes, there is certainly money that is not included in this $14 billion tally, which is, of course, a projection, so it could be higher or lower. But we know that there's money that was spent really to shape the outcomes of federal elections that was spent before the reporting windows, and so it was not reported to the Federal Election Commission. That may be money that was identified a candidate. It's clear to every viewer what the purpose of the ad is, but it's not considered necessarily political. And so if it doesn't fall into that 30-day window before a primary or a 60-day window before the general, that would not necessarily be caught.
The election that has so many Americans' eyeballs right now, and so the attention of so many Americans, is over in Georgia, where there's a Senate runoff on January 5th, which essentially could decide which party controls the Senate. How much money, Sheila, are we expected to see flooding into these campaigns leading up to the election? We mentioned that individual donors have a cap at $2,800, but outside of the individual donors, I imagine there will be super PACs and other special interest groups, including folks over at the Lincoln Project, for example, who may be putting money towards advertising or other efforts to elect their candidate.
Yes, we won't see the reports on spending by the candidates until actually late December, quite a ways from now. But we can already see from ad buys that $45 million was spent in just the first week after runoffs were announced, mostly by the campaigns, but other important large super PACs. The Senate Leadership Fund has already pledged $9 million for between the two races. Mitch McConnell allied American Crossroads has already placed $3.3 million in ads. So the money is already stacking up. This is, you know, a huge focus now. Of course, all eyes are on Georgia. There could be some donor fatigue, but I think that most believe the money will be huge, both from the campaigns and especially from outside groups, given, as you say, the races could decide party control of the Senate. And standalone special elections like this typically draw a ton of money. But this one, you know, it's all hands on deck for sure.
Sheila Krumholz is the executive director of the Center for Responsive Politics, a nonpartisan, nonprofit group that researches money in politics. Sheila, thanks for helping us out with this.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Major League Baseball made history last week when they announced Kim Eng as the Miami Marlins general manager. This is the first time any woman, let alone a woman of color, will be in the top job for a Major League Baseball team. Here's what Eng had to say to all those young people who might want to follow in her footsteps.
Anything is possible. Just work your butt off, keep your nose to the grindstone. It's great to have people block for you every once in a while. Soak up all the information you can, but anything is possible.
And with that remarkable accomplishment, there will almost certainly come a tough road ahead. Joining me now is Jane McManus, director for the Marist Center for Sports Communication and a sports columnist for Deadspin. Jane, nice to have you back on the show.
Always happy to be here.
So Kim Eng was not a surprising choice, at least internally, for the role. She had tried for this job a number of times before, right?
She said that she has tried out for a general manager position or been interviewed for one at least 5 times and probably many, many more than that. The last 9 years, she's been working in Major League Baseball's front office, basically just waiting for her opportunity to come along.
Is that typical for general managers? Is it often a job that requires multiple, you know, tries before you're anointed, if you will?
Well, let's be absolutely clear. Kim Eng has been qualified for this job for the last decade. She has been at the place where typically men in baseball are getting their first general manager opportunities. The problem is it's not like applying for a job, in a conventional setting. You have to be chosen by somebody who's an owner and who wants to put you in a role where you are doing all of the negotiating when it comes to the team, when it comes to players. You're the front-facing person who's talking to the media, who's talking to other owners, who's interacting with baseball on behalf of this team. So you really do have to have someone who backs you and says, you're the person. And, you know, unfortunately, for the last decade, Kim Eng has been qualified and been ready, but hasn't been able to find someone who was willing to invest her with that kind of power.
Let's talk a little bit about her career, because you know a lot more about her trajectory than a lot of people. What's her career in Major League Baseball look like up to this point?
Well, she's been, you know, in the front office of various teams since 2001, when she was with the Yankees and as an assistant GM, and she went on to be in the Dodgers front office. She also was with Chicago, and then for the last 9 years, she's been in baseball's front office, where she's served on a lot of committees involving like diversity and different things like that with baseball, trying to figure out how can baseball be more proactive about having opportunities available for women and people of color. And there is some irony there, right? That she has been in this position where, you know, with a lot of other people in baseball, there are just a handful of women who have roles that, like the one that Kim Eng had, these assistant GM roles, you know, number 2, 3, 4 in an organization. And Kim Eng was at the head of some of these diversity committees trying to figure out how can we get more women in baseball. And really, she'd been ready for this opportunity for that long as she was serving on these committees.
So what do you think tipped the scales this time around for her, given the fact that she's interviewed and tried for this job a bunch of times, beside the fact that obviously, as we've stated multiple times, she is eminently qualified for this role? What do you think tipped the scales in terms of the Marlins giving her this opportunity?
You know, I think part of it is staying power. You know, when you stick around and you say, you know, I'm not going to go anywhere, you can pass me over for a job, and I know I'm here for this and I'm going to stick with it, which is something that Kim Eng has said that she's done. I think that's part of it. I think Major League Baseball probably got involved and was encouraging teams to give her a more serious look rather than just an interview. I also think the fact that she probably had a longstanding relationship with Derek Jeter, who is part of the Marlins organization. You know, here's a relatively young person. He was a biracial player, so he knows what it's like to break a barrier or to be, you know, an icon who represents something more than just himself, who also understands that idea of celebrity and who understands how somebody can have an impact well beyond the job that they hold. So I think all of those things kind of came around and led to an opportunity where it was time and where she was the person for the job.
Jane, not only is Kim Eng a woman, she is also an Asian American woman. Why does that matter for the MLB at large?
Major League Baseball has really struggled with diversity in its ranks. And in particular, you see this with the way that there were a certain number of black players. Famously, Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. And now you've just seen that they haven't been able to kind of keep that momentum. There is diversity when it comes to Latino players, players of Hispanic origin. But other than that, there have been fewer and fewer black players who've been drawn to the game. They haven't done as well, and certainly in terms of leadership roles. I mean, really, you know, professional sports in general don't do a good job with putting people of color in leadership roles, and obviously women, since Kim Eng is the first one who served as a general manager now across the big four sports leagues in the United States. But it also, in particular, are people of color, and being able to serve in those roles. You know, Kim Eng has told stories of hearing racial slurs, you know, from people in baseball because of her race, and which is completely unacceptable. So to be able to cross that line and to be able to have a role where she has real power and authority, you know, it means something. It means something not only for people outside of baseball, but it also sends a message to people within the game.
Now, we've talked on this show about what it feels like to be the first or the only, and in this case, Kim Eng will be the first and the only woman of color, Asian American woman, and woman at the top of a Major League Baseball team. When you are the first and the only, there will be challenges. What do we expect Kim Eng to have to confront as she moves forward in this role?
Well, that's a great point. And as we know, when you're representative not just of yourself and your own talent, but you're representative of a group of people or a demographic.
Which is unfortunate, and it happens to many people who are the first and the only. They can't just be who they are and be done. It almost is like we are representing, you know, an entire group of people.
100%. So I think a lot of people can probably relate to that, having been that person or having seen that person in action, you know, in their own worlds. And so unfortunately, her failures will not just be hers, but they will be considered by some to be representative of what women or people of color are capable of as a general manager. You know, she has, and many people in a role like that also have a cultural issue. Now, she's been in baseball for 30 years, and she understands that culture. And, you know, as do any women who work in professional sports or who work in a male-dominated field, you have to be aware of what those dynamics are and how you sit on the outside of a lot of those dynamics all the time, and how to negotiate that tension. So obviously she is familiar with that and how to do that, but she will be looked at, you know, as somebody, she'll be scrutinized, I think probably more closely. Her decisions could be questioned more closely because of where they are coming from. You know, there are a lot of white men who've had jobs as general managers. They flame out, they don't do very well, they're just there for a couple of years and then they leave and then they go back to an assistant role. Well, if that were to happen to her, it will obviously, you know, feel different, I think, for a lot of people watching this. And you never know how much of a shot somebody is actually getting. Yes, it's one thing to have the role. Will she be empowered fully in the way that many men who have this role are? You know, how much autonomy is she going to have? How much respect will she be given as her due by the people that she's interacting with? These are all questions, I think, that have yet to be answered.
And you mentioned how much power she will have. As general manager, typically that role is extraordinarily powerful. What are some of the things that could limit or curb her power there? Are they things that are less tangible, like a team that might not want to take its orders from a woman? Or are there blocks, other political blocks that could happen?
You know, just as with any field where you have a working environment, there are political tensions within an organization all of the time. You know, an owner, perhaps, who wants to put his or her stamp, generally in professional sports, it's his stamp on a team, who wants to be the final authority in smaller decisions, micromanaging. You may have, you know, interactions with somebody who doesn't feel comfortable working with her for whatever reason, and she has to make sure that that is not holding her back. You know, all of these little political situations that she will have to negotiate as a general manager. You know, there's a reason there's a glass ceiling in baseball. And that's because it's been put there by these structural forces that have existed in baseball, you know, for the last 100 years. Those haven't gone away just because she got this job. She's still going to have to negotiate the vestiges of those ideas that have kept women out of positions like general manager and coaching positions and reffing positions. There are lots of positions in professional sports that have nothing to do with gender, and yet women are often kept out of them for reasons that have nothing to do with that.
Well, then I'm curious, Jane, more broadly, when we think about women in professional sports, or I should say male-dominated professional sports, Kim Ng is one example. I believe there's in the NFL, for example, there's a woman assistant coach on one
Katie
of the
Sowers.
Teams, but there's still so few and far between. Does this indicate a broader shift?
Yes, it is a broader shift. Because there are women in the pipeline of all of these major leagues, you do have Katie Sowers in the NFL as an assistant coach. You do have Becky Hammond, who's ready for a head coaching job in the NBA and should ultimately get it. So there are women who are able to take advantage of some opportunities that are becoming available. You know, in the NBA, you have women who've played this game since they were able to walk. There's no reason that opportunities in the NBA should be limited only to men. So I think you're seeing some of these attitudes change, whether it's, you know, whether it comes to coaching, whether it comes to refereeing, all of these different things. Scouting is another example of a role that can be filled by a woman that doesn't have anything to do with gender, and which women can do just as well as men. So the idea is it's not really about the skill set that women bring, the love of the game that women bring, the familiarity with the rules and the game that women can bring also. It really is about these structural issues that hold them back, the idea that sports are a boys' club and that girls aren't allowed. That's really what women are dealing with, and they have to deal with it kind of at all levels. Each woman who comes into a sport in this role has to figure out how to negotiate those political dynamics on her own. And so there's a great informal network of women across sports who are working to excel in a sport, and they rely on each other.
Jane McManus is director of the Marist Center for Sports Communication and a sports columnist for Deadspin. Jane, thanks so much for being with us as always.
Appreciate the conversation, Tanzana.
Director Steve McQueen is perhaps best known for his Best Picture-winning film, 12 Years a Slave, and his 2018 crime drama, Widows. But for his latest project, the British filmmaker decided to return home to direct not just one, but five films that make up the anthology series Small Acts. Together, the films tell mostly true stories of Black British life from the 1960s to the 1980s. The first part in the series, Mangrove, premieres this week on Amazon Prime and focuses on an undertold part of British history from the late 1960s. Here's how Steve McQueen describes the events that inspired his film.
There was a man called Frank Critchlow who opened a restaurant on All Saints Road in Labrogrove, Notting Hill, called Mangrove. This restaurant was for the West Indian community. It was like a home away from home. And this, it became a threat to the authorities for some reason. I imagine it became a threat because this is where intellectuals, thinkers, Black thinkers were congregating, and that they wanted to disrupt and break up this sort of legitimate business because it attracted so many people who had ideas.
Eventually, Critchlow and other Black leaders organized a demonstration to protest how law enforcement officials were targeting the Mangrove.
This demonstration, which took place, turned, unfortunately, into a situation where the police sort of infiltrated the crowd, and it was sort of deemed as a riot by the police. And nine people were arrested and charged with riot and affray, all because they were demonstrating their right to exist.
McQueen's film centers around the trial of the group, which became known as the Mangrove Nine. And all nine of them were ultimately acquitted of the most serious charges. The trial included one of the first judicial acknowledgement of racism within the British police force. To learn more about the story and why McQueen chose to bring it to the screen, I spoke with the director alongside the actress Letitia Wright, one of the stars of Mangrove. And McQueen told me why the story of the Mangrove Nine has been so overlooked.
I used to lie on my living room floor, hands propping up my head, watching the TV. And often my father's friends would come in, they would chat and talk. And one of those friends that used to come in a lot, in fact, my father grew up in a place called Paradise in Grenada with Rodan Gordon. Rodan Gordon was one of the Mangrove Nine. And I had no idea until about 15 years ago. No one spoke about it. And I don't know what it was, if it was a certain sense of trauma and not wanting to sort of revisit, had a lot to do with it. So it's in some ways, it's about people not actually communicating in it as well, because to go back, they had to deal with a lot of trauma. So it's understandable that often these stories aren't spoken about. I remember very clearly when I was doing the press for 12 Years a Slave, and we were in Atlanta. I think it was Atlanta. And this lady stood up and said to me that her father was poisoned for teaching children how to read. And she had never said that before. And she only said that because we were promoting 12 Years a Slave. So when people have an opportunity to speak, when they feel they're going to be heard, because so often they weren't, and they were not wanting to, people, she felt not they were not wanting to be heard. When there's a vessel, when there's an opportunity for people to be heard, then people will speak. And I think that's what it's about. There's so much drama and so much people sort of dealing with that. And therefore, I think I understand why things weren't sort of actually, you know, passed on often.
This film, or the films that you've created here, Steve, touch on racism, police brutality, and so many of the issues that are relevant to this moment right now. We've witnessed the uprising here in the United States against racial injustice in the name of George Floyd. And so, Steve, before I get to Letitia, where were you when you witnessed this?
Well, I was in Amsterdam. And I remember very vividly that there was that one of the first demonstrations in Europe was in Amsterdam, where the mayor said that they're going to organize, mayor of Amsterdam sort of organized a demonstration in Dam Square. And the police thought there would be maybe 300 people there. So they only had, I don't know how many police there. I don't know, maybe they had 50 police, if that, there. more than 10,000 people turned up in Dam Square in Amsterdam. It was incredible. The reverberations around the world, you saw what happened in Bristol with this sort of the statue of the slave being torn down. Everywhere, you know, around the world, it was echoed. So again, it's a world movement. Yes, it's a US, this obviously George Floyd and whatever, but I think people are understanding it more and more and more.
Letitia, when you saw this movement start here in the United States and, to Steve's point, sort of make its way around the world, where were you?
I was here in the UK, and again, social media has a way of connecting us all for the good and for the bad too. And, you know, seeing this image and this video on your timeline and on your time, your time feed, Instagram, Twitter, makes you really sad. And so I was here in the UK, and we were really remorseful with our brothers and sisters, you know, across the pond. And yeah, it was a sad time, you know, definitely a sad time.
And Letitia, how does it feel to release this film at a time when so many people around the world are continuing to take to the streets, maybe not at the levels that we saw back in May and June over the summer, but the film itself is about, essentially about the right to protest?
Yes, we filmed this last year, and we didn't know what was around the corner in 2020, of course. And I remember when we got into Cannes, Steve called, you know, to be courteous enough to share the news with me and just let me know what was going on in terms of the reception of the film. And he said, it's crazy how life is imitating the art that we just created, and art is imitating life. And I remember just really taking that and coming off the phone, and again, just it hitting you that, you know, we set out to show and represent these stories that have been untold, and rightly so, by what Steve said, you know, due to traumatic experiences not coming to the surface, you know, at that time. And now the bravery for us to like step out and share it, and the necessity for us to step out and share it. And just looking at something that happened, the right to protest and the right to demonstrate when you're not treated fairly and with justice, and just taking a peek into what happened 50 years ago in Notting Hill. And now you have 2020, 50 years on, you're still having to conduct the same type of route in order to be heard. And for me, as a young person, seeing our world and just finishing this project and seeing the reception of it, again, you know, it's a hard one. It's hard because you feel sad. You feel sad that 50 years on, you know, after the mangrove demonstration, what they were fighting for, we're still fighting for today. And that says a lot about us as a society, that so much needs to change. And in the words of Althea in our project, like, enough is enough, like, it needs to stop. You know, we shouldn't have to take to the streets anymore because of prejudice, because of the color of my skin. I shouldn't have to do that anymore, but unfortunately we are. So it resonates. It wasn't our intention to didn't predict that this was going to happen. It was just our intention to showcase the stories that have been untold. But as you can see, the same stories that have been untold and we're presenting to you, we now have them being replicated within our society today in some form and fashion, and it's sad. It makes me sad as a young person to see that.
When we're talking about life imitating art and art imitating life, when creatives of color enter very white spaces, both of you are Black artists working in a very white industry, and that's similar to here in the United States. Steve, in fact, you wrote a piece for The Observer this summer calling out the whiteness of the British film industry. And you said, quote, "The UK is so far behind in terms of representation, it's shameful." Here in the United States, we've often said, you know, Oscar's so white, for example, and we've seen some change. But what's your experience, Steve, been in terms of being a Black artist today, trying to change that industry from the inside?
Well, I'm very robust. I just get on with it. I just feel that, you know, stick my elbows out and bring some people with me. I don't really see them as white spaces. Yes, they are. But if I was to think, adopt that, I don't think I'll be able to sort of, these are art spaces. And the fact that these are art spaces and that these spaces are unfair to people of color shows me it's not a healthy environment. So, you know, we have to change the environment. And, you know, how I do that is by work, is by, you know, you spoke to me earlier on about the whole idea of bringing stories in. And I said that I'm an artist, not a journalist. Now, what I mean by that is with Letitia playing Anthony LeQuant, I mean, it's a situation where she transcends and transforms into this performance that she did that could never be written in a novel, that can never be sort of documented within history, because you've got to feel it in a way of seeing it. You have to experience it through seeing it. And that's film for me. That's television for me. Well, the best sort of film and television, when you can actually get a situation where you're there sitting and witnessing a performance which can transcend and transform, and that you believing. And that was something that Letitia sort of did, which journalism can't do and literature can't do. And that's the magic of film in whatever guise, if it's streaming or in the cinema. And I think that's what we can offer culture. That's what we can offer with this medium, something other than those two examples I gave before.
Letitia, there is so much conversation, including this conversation, about Black struggle, Black resistance, and anti-Blackness in this world. And one of the things that's resonating a lot with me in particular is how resistance can also be translated into Black joy, and that joy in and of itself is a form of resistance. And I'm wondering, when it's so hard in this moment to feel optimistic about anything, is anything that you are doing giving you joy? Are you finding joy in this moment?
Of course. You know, I don't want it to come across as every Black experience is filled with tragedy and trauma and unhappiness, because that's not the truth. We are a worldwide global connection of the diaspora, so that in a sense is there's joy in so many aspects of who we are. Particularly, I would say yes, I experience joy just as anybody else would. You know, it's sad that, you know, that we are placed in this box of this thing where it's like you're just being seen as the race that's always seen as not happy or not being treated well. And there's such a problem with that, because there is so much Black joy, and especially within small acts, you know, we do touch on the seriousness of prejudice and the seriousness of the issues that come to the forefront that we need to discuss and talk about. But embedded and interwoven into all of those scenes and moments is predominantly joy, because as human beings, that's who we are. At the core of who we are is joy, you know, joyful people. So we see that throughout small acts, not just in our film, but throughout all the films, we see beautiful moments of joy. We see people celebrating music, food. We see people just celebrating, you know, times of their family. You know, what causes that joy to be stifled is someone's choice to take that away from someone, is someone's mindset to rob someone else, another human being, of that. And for me, in terms of joy in my life, yes, of course, in this moment, in this time, yes, of course, you can find joy in every aspect of life.
Steve, what about you? How are you finding joy in this moment?
I'm feeling joy. so much because people are speaking their truth, often for the first time in public. It's incredible. It's like, it's a cascade. It's an avalanche. You know, it's beautiful. It's like, let rivers flow. It's hearing these beautiful voices talking about, yes, pain, but also joy of actually being able to express themselves. So many people, I get the impression, have been sort of muffled, and now there's a release. It's beautiful. It's like, you know, I want to dance. It's kind of incredible. We always take tragedy and take it and make it into triumph. We've always done that. In everything that we've done in life, we've always taken things and made it into something special. That's who we are as bad people. That's who we are.
Steve McQueen is the writer and director of the anthology series Small Acts, and Letitia Wright is one of the stars of the series. Steve and Letitia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's our show for today, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in. These are very tough times, so I'm hoping that we can bring you some comfort during the pandemic. And please stay safe out there. And of course, you can call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.